Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I really had to make a shot plan of essentially every shot in the film, not just because I had to organize where this large cast of principals in most shots, but also because I had to know when one or two of them could not be seen in a shot because they were away somewhere else killing someone.
Welcome back to Light the Views presents The Directors, where myself, Drew Taylor, and my vivacious co-host, Charles Hood, go through the Paramount Library, finding some of the very best movies that Paramount has made and talking to the filmmakers behind those movies, getting insight into their process and how the film came together. And this week, Charles, we are back with Jonathan Lynn, director of Clue. Ooh, who done it? Who is responsible for the murders?
Wow. Yeah. Thank you. That's a good introduction to the movie, Drew. It's also very funny, too. You know, I mean, it's mainly a comedy, I would say.
It is. But there's a whodunit. We've all played Clue.
But I feel like in the end, it's less about whodunit, considering, you know, the number of ways that it ends, that it could be, it sort of is all of them in a way.
Oh, spoiler, Charles. It's okay. It's a very old film.
Yeah, it's not really all of them, right? I mean, you'll see. It has multiple endings. You'll see. If you haven't seen it, watch it. It's a classic.
Yes, and we really appreciate Jonathan Lynn taking the time to talk to us about this movie. It's a movie that's very much in the zeitgeist. There was a 4K disc that was sold out around Christmas, and everybody wanted it, all the nerds, and... Yeah.
We also get into some other parts of his career today, which is great to hear him talk about some of these movies. The Distinguished Gentleman, he tells a great Bruce Willis story for The Whole Nine Yards. And he talks about My Cousin Vinny, which is cool to hear as well. So there's some good stuff today. I think you'll love it.
I think so too, Charles. Should we just jump right into it?
Let's do it. Let's get in there.
I had a question about the setting, you know, the period setting. It's set in 1954. The original board game came out about a decade earlier. But this has all this great kind of Cold War paranoia. Was that the reason? I mean, you do this great joke. It was a red herring over and over again. I mean, was that sort of the impetus for that?
It had to be a period film, I thought. This is a period idea. The country house murder mystery. You know, made most famous by Agatha Christie, but other writers, Dorothy Sayers, you know, a large number of other people wrote this kind of mystery. And they were all set really between the wars or shortly after the war. I felt it had to be a period piece, especially as it was all, and it had to be rather theatrical because it was all set in one big house, you know, one big set really. So I started thinking about what do I really know about America? And what I knew was a great screenwriter called Donald Ogden Stewart. He had won the Oscar for Philadelphia Story and had written many other films. He was the first president of the writers, it was called the Screenwriters Guild in those days. And he had been blacklisted in 1954 because he'd refused to name names to the McCarthy and American Activities Committee. And he'd come to England, where I had got to know him. I was in my early 20s, he was in his 70s. And over the course of time, many nice afternoons having tea at his house, I met other expatriate Americans who had been blacklisted. Ring Lardner Jr., who subsequently wrote the film of MASH. Waldo Salt, who subsequently wrote Midnight Cowboy. And London was full of expatriate American writers of real distinction, Carl Foreman, Charlie Chaplin. And I met most of these people at Don's house. And I discovered that they were all very funny and very angry. And so I became an expert on this particular period of American history. So I thought that's a good road into this script, because if people were going to be invited to this country house and by someone who was threatening them and had given them all aliases, and they wouldn't have turned up unless they felt threatened or had some dark secret. So it seemed to me a really good secret in those days would be a political secret. And I've always enjoyed writing scripts about politics and the idiocy of so much of what goes on. And so I thought, okay, let's make it about McCarthyism. So there's not very much about McCarthyism in the movie. There was going to be more, but Paramount wouldn't let me shoot it. I was going to have an opening title sequence with the cook watching the Army McCarthy hearings on the TV in the kitchen. But I hadn't put that in the script. And when we got to the end of the shoot and I said, well, now let's do the title sequence. Nobody had told me the title sequence had to be written in the script originally and budgeted for. So Paramount said, no, we're not giving you any more money. So I couldn't do it. Does that answer your question?
So it wasn't, they weren't censoring you. They just didn't want to pay for it.
They didn't want to pay for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the reason studios usually say no to things.
That's true. That's true.
I want to ask about the music. The song choices are all so great and perfect for the tone. Obviously they're perfect for the time as well. But John Morris's score, all the music he did for Mel Brooks's movies is so amazing. How did John Morris get on, and what was your working relationship with him like?
John Morris, I was a big fan of his from the Mel Brooks movies. And I just sent him the script and said, would you write the music for this? And he said, yes. So that was easy.
It's pretty interesting because he didn't really work that much outside of Mel Brooks and that kind of sphere. Like I think he did Gene Wilder movies and
Well, I guess he thought this was sufficiently insane to be part of that. I don't know. In those days, there weren't synthesizers, of course. So in those days, composers played you their score on the piano.
Right.
And then you would talk to them about it, and you'd say, well, this is strings, and that line there is woodwind. Is that the flute or is that, and you went through what the orchestration would be. You never really heard it. You never heard a rough of it or anything at all, because there weren't computers with music. So it wasn't until you're in the recording studio, actually recording the music, that you hear it as it was meant to be. But it was easier for me than it might have been for some people, because I'd been a musician earlier in my life. So when we talked about orchestration, I could imagine what it was going to sound like. And, I thought he did a superb job.
Yeah. What is that main instrument? Is it like a harpsichord or something? Or what is that primary kind of sound for the main melody that's in it? Do you know?
I think it's just the string section, isn't it?
I guess. I don't know, just the sound of it is so unique. It's just really wonderful.
I don't think there was any special instruments involved. I think it was just, your basic orchestra.
Right.
I think that was maybe the first time Charles had heard an instrument.
I'd never heard an instrument before. It's the first time.
Yeah.
What is this music?
I think it was violins, violas, cellos, and basses, and a few woodwind. But I really can't remember. I'd have to listen to it. I'd really have to listen to it again to answer that question.
We'll be back with more from Jonathan Lynn after the break.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Ryder, and Ashley Nicole Moss, 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Rise and shine, football fans. Start your day the right way with Morning Footy, a podcast that covers every aspect of the global game, headlines, match previews, analysis, interviews, culture, fashion, and plenty of banter. Join as we track the thrills and spills of Europe's biggest title races, the business end of the Champions League season, a summer packed with international competitions, MLS, NWSL, and much more. Subscribe to Morning Footy.
So this is very early in your directing career.
It was my first film.
Yeah, you'd done maybe a TV movie before this or something?
No, I'd done an advertising short.
Oh, okay, wow. So this is your first movie. And kind of maybe the hardest thing you can do is write a movie with a large ensemble in every single scene.
That's right.
How was that for you as a first time director to do, you know, scene after scene after scene with 6-7 people having to cover that? How'd it go? Were you able to stay on schedule?
No. No, we certainly didn't stay on schedule. I was off schedule after the first day, because like the dogs wouldn't do what I wanted them to, which started the scene with the dogs. That was a big mistake by Deborah and the production manager. I mean, everybody knows that working with animals is tricky. For some reason, they'd put Wadsworth's Arrival with the dogs on the first day. So I was already behind after day one.
Oh, gosh.
Which was a bit scary. I think we ended up about 8 or 9 days behind schedule. But not, I don't think that affected the budget. I may be wrong about that, but I don't think so. And yes, it was very hard. I really had to make a shot plan of essentially every shot in the film, not just because I had to organize where this large cast of principals in most shots, but also because I had to know when one or two of them could not be seen in a shot or a succession of shots because they were away somewhere else killing something. So it just was a lot of meticulous planning. And I don't think there's anything else to say about that, but it was very hard. I mean, most films have one or two principals in a scene, maybe three or four even. And then 1,000 extras is no problem. Lots of principals is a problem.
Right.
I wanted to ask about the movie's release because it seems like it was not as warmly received as we would imagine with hindsight and us being here at 2024. Did that surprise you that the movie was not more warmly received when it came out?
It disappointed me.
Yes.
I don't know how surprised I was. I didn't know what to expect. Mm-hmm. I thought that this business of the multiple endings was potentially catastrophic. I thought that we'd got a really bad opening day. We opened on Friday, December the 13th. And in those days, leading up to Christmas, was the worst week or so of the year. You know, there was a general sense that people were preparing for Christmas and Granny was coming to stay and people were putting up a Christmas tree and nobody was going to the movies. And certainly was a bad movie-going weekend. What I wasn't really prepared for was the reviews, which were, they weren't terrible, mostly. They were just lukewarm. They were mediocre.
Right.
There were one or two really good ones. There was a really good one in Variety, I think. And there were one or two other good reviews. But essentially, they weren't very good. And I think I understood why subsequently. And I think it's because, you know, the ending is very important. The ending, in a way, sums up what a film is about. That's what you leave the audience with. And if the filmmaker can't decide how to end the film, then the critics are rather impatient with that. And the concept of multiple endings was profoundly mysterious and pointless to them. And so the reviews were not very good. There was bad weather on the East Coast. I mean, there was everything you could put together to have a bad opening weekend. And we had a bad opening weekend.
It's funny. I was just revisiting Roger Ebert's review. And in his review, he says that they should have put all three endings. I think he said he went and saw each one, or they screened all three endings for him. And he said, why didn't they just put all three in the same movie?
Well, he was right. I don't remember any of the reviews. Just remember a general sense of what they were. On the whole, I don't remember reviews, and I try not to read them. I think, like many people in my business,
it's had such a cult following in the years since. Did that element surprise you? I mean, this Blu-ray, the 4K disc, completely sold out. I mean, that's insane.
What was that?
This recent 4K disc that Shout put out, it had sold out.
I didn't know there was one.
Oh yeah, there is. Yeah, and it was a huge hit. So I mean, it's certainly had legs. Yeah.
Everything about the film surprised me.
Okay.
The idea of the film, the making of the film, the way it was received on release, and then the fact that it became intensely popular over the next several years. The whole thing was a big surprise to me. One thing after another.
I love that.
I have to ask you before we go on about other things in your career. I've always been curious about this. It looks like there is, I may be wrong about this, but it looks like there is one handheld shot in this movie, which is when Tim Curry runs over and turns off the power when he's in the middle of his manic recapping everything that happens. And I'm just curious why handheld for just that one shot. Was it out of necessity, or was it because that's sort of the anchor for all the different endings?
I have no idea.
This is something that's been haunting me for years. I've been wondering, why is this handheld in this one shot? It looks so distinct to me. It's like you see everybody in the ensemble, and he runs over and grabs the handle. And
I can't remember. I'm really sorry.
That's okay. I was just curious. that Tim Curry running around doing that is so amazing. Was that how you imagined it when you wrote it?
Yes.
I mean, did Tim Curry bring something more to it? I mean, he's such a genius in that sequence.
He brought his own wonderful personality to it.
Right.
But yes, it was staged precisely as I thought when I wrote it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, it's amazing. Well, there are plenty of other movies in your filmography I'd love to talk about. I don't know, Drew, do you have anything else you wanted to ask about Clue? Sorry, before we ask about anything else.
No, I mean, I think that pretty much covers it for me. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to say we've interviewed Paul Hirsch many times over the years. He's one of our favorites. He's an amazing editor. He edited some John Hughes movies, and he had huge compliments to say about The Distinguished Gentleman, which is a great movie that is really hard to find now. And I had to track it down just to revisit it because I watched it so much as a kid, and it still holds up. It's a great movie. I wish it was around more. Can you talk about your experience making that movie with Eddie Murphy?
Yes. I don't know why it's been kind of obliterated over time. I was very pleased with it. It's a bit too long. We only had 6 weeks in post-production, and we had to get in a second editor. And I needed a bit more time to fine it down. When I did the TV version, which I don't know if it still exists, I got 10 minutes out of it, and I thought it was a lot better.
Interesting.
Apart from that, I mean, I think it's a wonderful idea. The tricky part of making the film is that the first 70 minutes is all comedy. And then there's a sudden change of direction when the small child is revealed as having cancer. And I had said to Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was head of the studio, and to Marty Kaplan, who was the writer, and I thought this change of direction was a bit of a problem, and that we either needed to make the first half slightly less funny so people weren't disappointed when the laughs petered out, or we had to make the second half funnier. They didn't agree with me. They thought that it was a sort of wonderful sort of Frank Capra type twist to go from something really funny to something really serious. So that's what we did. And there was a problem with audiences when we showed it, because they laughed a lot for the first 70 minutes. And then for the next 15 minutes or so, they were more or less silent. And then we got some laughs back towards the end of the film. But I felt there was a structural flaw there. And that may be why the film hasn't remained popular across the board. And I loved working with Eddie. He had a not very good reputation at the time. He was supposed to be rude and difficult, and films went way over budget because he argued with everything all the time. I found him delightful from start to finish, and very creative, very funny. I loved working with him. And what else can I say about it? Well, I think the reason why it didn't open as well as it should have is that Jeffrey Katzenberg showed it to the Speaker of the House. I've forgotten his name now. Tom something. Hoping to get his approval. The Speaker said it was an attack on the Democratic Party and on him. And he was really upset about it. So I thought that was a good thing to promote because it was a political satire. Jeffrey refused to do that, being a Democrat. So what happened was, it wasn't promoted as a satire, but as an, quote, Eddie Murphy comedy. And I think people went along surprised to discover the content of the film. But that's all speculation on my part. Certainly when Bill Clinton, he was about to become president, he'd won the election when the film came out, and he was filmed coming out of a cinema in Arkansas, laughing and saying, that's just what Washington is all about. And I phoned Jeffrey and said, can we use this clip of Bill Clinton in our publicity? And he said, no. So the film is about the power of the lobbyists. And I think, and it was well before its time.
Yeah.
But I think it got into the hands of the lobbyists for when it came to marketing. And I think the lobbyists kind of castrated it a bit. So, but I liked the film. I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. We'll be back with more from Jonathan Lynn after the break.
You worked with Bruce Willis in The Whole Nine Yards, and I was wondering, as we were kind of looking back on his career, like what that experience was like, if you had any good stories about Bruce.
Oh, lots. I don't know where to begin, really. It was a low-budget film being produced by his brother, David Willis. And David went to his brother, Bruce, and said, can you help me find some money for this? Bruce read it and, to David's surprise, said, I'd like to play Jimmy the Tulip, which was not the leading part. And the fact that Bruce said he wanted to be in it meant it immediately got set up the next day, really. And then we were very fortunate to get Matthew Perry, who was extremely funny and nice to work with. And the rest of the cast, Amanda Peet was utterly brilliant, I thought. And all the rest of the cast were really good. And it was written to be shot in Miami. It was about Miami. And Eli Samaha, who was the producer, who ran Celebrity Cleaners, and he somehow found the money for the film, starting his own film production company, Mini Studio. And he said, well, I've got a deal in Toronto, in Montreal, you're shooting it there. And I said, well, Montreal doesn't look much like Miami. I can't think of a city that looks much less like Miami. And he said, but that's where you're going to shoot it. So I had to think, and I thought, well, it better be set in Montreal. So that was moved. The action was moved to Montreal. And he wanted stories about Bruce Willis. He was one of the producers. And so he had an interest in the film being shot fast. But it was low budget. It was only a $10 million below the line. There were stories. Elie Samaha put out stories to the press that it was $40 million film. I don't know why. It wasn't. It was $10 million below the line, plus a little bit above the line for probably $12 million in total. And then there was Bruce's enormous fee on top of that, but that only came to about 20-something. Now, Bruce wanted it shot on time. So he said, what can I do to help? And I said, well, don't leave the set. Now, most movie stars, when the shot is finished, they go back to their trailer and they get on the phone to their agents, managers, publicists, or they just hang out. And then you have to extract them from the trailer and time has gone by. And I said, if we're going to shoot this in 35 days, we have to move very fast from one shot to the next. So I had a wonderful cameraman called David Franco who could do that. And Bruce, at my request, stayed on the set after every shot, ran the lines with the other actors, and was always ready to go. It was a huge help. So we managed to shoot a lot in every day. There were a couple of days when that didn't work, when he said to me, I'm leaving at lunchtime. And I said, why? He said, well, I'm flying to Texas to do a fundraiser for George W. Bush. So I said, well, he said, oh, yeah, I'm going to do that. So we had to shoot rather a lot that morning. And there were a few occasions when he and I disagreed quite firmly about things. He had very strong views. There was one moment when we were doing a shot and I think he was fed up and he wanted to go home. It was late at night. And we did a rehearsal. I said, that's funny. And he said, well, let's shoot it. I said, well, no, we're not lit yet. And he said, it looks all right to me. And I said, no, we're not lit. This is a working light. So he said, no, we're shooting it now. And I said, no. And he said, that's one of his... Entourage said, did he say no? And we waited, and there was really no question. You know, Bruce was the man who, he was a producer, and he was getting $10 million. And so we did what he wanted. We shot it in the working light. And, of course, we cut the scene because it looked hopeless. But he got home that night. And there are other days when... He was extraordinarily helpful. We had a day on a boat. And he said to me in rehearsal, how many days are we going to have on this boat? Four? And I said, one. He said, what? How are we going to do it? And I said, well, we're going to have a small boat. The only people on the boat are going to be you, Matthew, the DP, who's going to also be operating the camera, and me, and the first assistant. And he said, what about hair and makeup? And I said, well, you're going to see them in the morning and at lunchtime. Well, he was very concerned because he was losing his hair at that time and it was rather thin. And he had been, we'd been very careful not to light it in such a way that you could see how thin his hair was all the way through the film. He said, what about my hair? And I said, you're going to have to wear a hat. So he agreed. And we rehearsed the scene. And several weeks later, when we came to shoot it, he and Matthew remembered everything we'd rehearsed. And we did, in fact, get it done in one day.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
I know we're out of time. I just want to quickly ask you about Marissa Tomei winning the Oscar for My Cousin Vinny, another movie that I love. That also, I was just reading that like a lot of lawyers are saying it's how incredibly accurate it is. And is it true you have a law degree? Is that right?
Yes, I have a law degree. And I was...
Wow.
I've been asked to speak at conferences of federal judges and things.
Wow.
Which is because they say it's the only Hollywood film ever made where every legal point is correct. And obviously a lot of that is in Dale Lorna's script. But I was able to make a few other changes that corrected things that weren't right. And I don't know what else I can tell you about it. Yes, it's very popular with lawyers. It's used in law schools to teach the law of evidence. But that's not why I wanted to do it. I wanted to do it because it's an anti-capital punishment film. Although Fox described it to me when they gave it to me as a fish-out-of-water film, which is one of those bizarre genre ideas that doesn't really mean much. But for me, what was significant about it was that if Vinny hadn't been their lawyer, if he hadn't didn't have a lawyer who was so committed and aggressive and determined and obstinate, they would have been fried. And it would have been a huge miscarriage of justice. And I'm personally profoundly against capital punishment. And that struck me as a very important aspect of the film. It's not preachy in the film. I mean, the film is a comedy. But I thought that was important.
Was it a surprise, the Marissa Tomei Oscar win? How did you know?
Apparently it was to everybody else. It wasn't to me. Because all through the year, it opened in March.
She's amazing.
And for the rest of the year, anyone I ever met in the film industry said, who is that wonderful woman in Vinny?
Right.
So I knew that people just thought she was great.
Yeah.
And so obviously the odds were against her. Lots of more famous people were nominated. But I wasn't actually surprised.
Yeah. Well, and she's still killing it. She's still amazing.
Absolutely.
Well, we've taken up enough of your time. We really appreciate you coming on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
No, it was lovely. And please let us know if you need anything from us. We'll be there.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much.
And we are back from beyond with Jonathan Lynn and Charles Hood.
Hi.
What do you think? Tell us what you learned.
Yeah. How have we changed now since this conversation happened with Jonathan Lynn? What's different? What have we learned?
Well, I mean, it's lovely to hear from a filmmaker who is making comedies that were profitable and also critically acclaimed. I feel like that happens very rarely nowadays.
Yeah.
It's almost impossible to think of a movie like My Cousin Vinny winning an Oscar.
Yeah.
For a performance.
I also love that My Cousin Vinny has this like amazing reputation among lawyers too. That's like, fascinating to me. I have not watched it in years, and I'm going to revisit it because I want to see that side of it, that I guess like the legal side of the movie is very accurate because of Jonathan Lynn's background, which was also fascinating.
Yeah, that was really great. Yeah, and it was great hearing about Eddie Murphy and how he thinks. I think that movie is super underrated. He thinks it's underrated.
Yeah, and I love that. I went and sought it out after, you know, we always talk about Paul Hirsch, one of our favorite past guests. But editor Paul Hirsch had, I don't know if he mentioned it on air in one of our episodes or off the air to us, but he talked about how much he loves The Distinguished Gentleman, thinks that's a classic. And I was like, oh, wow, I should go back and watch it. So I did, and it's great. So, yeah, I wish that was more available to the world. I would tell people to watch it, but seek it out if you can find it, track it down.
Yes, I think it was one of those Disney, either Touchstone or Hollywood Pictures movies, and
yeah,
it's a little difficult to find, but it is out there.
And I love talking with him about John Morris. It was a really interesting composer who didn't really score for a lot of people outside of that Mel Brooks group of, you know, friends. He scored their movie. So it's awesome to have him come score Clue, which I think is a wonderful score. It's so distinct and great, really melodic. And I love that, the sound of it. And, you know, the violin theme in Young Frankenstein is just one of the most beautiful things. I love that. It's another one of my favorites. Yeah. Cool to hear about John Morris, because he just didn't score that much stuff, I feel like.
Yeah. What else, Charles?
I asked him about this because it's crazy to me that this was his first movie as a director. And I just want to, I know I brought it up in my question, but I just want to reiterate how hard it is to shoot a big ensemble in every single scene. You know, talked about it last week, the Julian Sands movie, that was like an ensemble. It was like six characters. It was basically six characters in every scene. And it's a nightmare. It's a lot of coverage. It's a lot of work. If you have to get close-ups of every single one of those actors, and you've got to get all the eye lines to work right and everything, it's a lot of work. It can be a disaster if you don't do it right. And for that to be your first movie, and he's doing it with more than six, I think it's got to be like at least seven people who are in almost every scene. That's wild to think about, and that it all works, and it's and that tonally it works too. That's what's really impressive to see from a directing standpoint.
Yeah, I agree. And also that just adds to the personalities on set and the amount that you're dealing with every day, I cannot imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, oh man, what a special movie. I love it so much. I know I've said it too many times. But also great to hear him tell the story. I didn't know how much, like, Bruce Willis was, like, did Whole Nine Yards, like, out of, like, for the passion for it. Like, he was, like, a low-budget movie that they, like, really kind of scrappily put together. It was kind of interesting to hear about that.
Yeah, that first one is a lot of fun. And what's interesting is that Howard Deutsch, our previous guest, directed the sequel, The Whole 10 Yards.
Yeah. So I think you texted me like immediately afterwards and pointed that out. And I was like, oh, man, that's crazy. that is really fun. What a crazy little coincidence there. And that's about it for me. I just want to tell everybody again that Clue, the movie, is available on DVD and Blu-ray and digital. And as you pointed out as well, it's on Paramount Plus streaming there. And we will do a giveaway again of the 4K UHD Shout Factory of Clue, which is a much sought after item. So pay attention to our social media, which I'm now going to turn over to you to tell everybody where to find us.
Well, thank you, Charles. Yes, you can find us at Light the Fuse Pod wherever you are social media-ing. And I also want to remind everybody to like, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast wherever you're listening to it. And we will be back next week with someone amazing. Charles, who's coming in next week?
Oh, man, this is really exciting. I am so excited to say that next week we have the one and only Oscar-winning writer and director Alexander Payne. So this is a really fun conversation we have with him. He obviously just directed The Holdovers, which just came out, but he did the Paramount classic, I would say. Would you agree? Election classic?
Let me just double check your math there, Charles, and it's coming back. Classic. Correct.
Okay, absolutely. I'm glad you checked the calculator on that one. Thank you.
Yep.
Yeah, so this is, I mean, Alexander Payne, one of my favorites, and it's a really fun conversation we have with him. I mean, he did Election and Sideways and The Descendants and Nebraska, and, you know, we talk about a lot of it. So it's very exciting.
And The Holdovers and Downsizing.
Yes.
We'll just talk about his whole filmography. We do talk about a lot of his filmography, so it is actually appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, because he made three movies with Paramount, so we get to talk about them. So it's cool.
Yes. And every time we mention a movie that's not Paramount, we get an electric shock. So we don't talk too much about them, but we do bring them up. And he is a wonderful, wonderful guest.
Yes.
All of our guests on this miniseries have been wonderful, but he's really lovely. And
you know, I'm starting to get used to the shock collar. It's starting to be like a thing I'm almost getting into. So it's okay for me to get shocked.
Yeah.
I'm okay. I'm just gonna power through.
Yeah, we lean in. We always lean in. So even with the shocks, we're leaning in. Yes. So come back for Alexander Payne. It's a wonderful chat. And we want to thank Jonathan again for his time and his amazing stories. This was a real thrill.
Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast, is produced by Charles Hood. That's me and Drew Taylor. Our supervising producer is Abby Smith. This episode was edited by Luke Burson with music by Kevin Blumenfeld. This podcast is a production of Paramount Pictures. All rights are reserved.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.